Welcome to Kingston Reid's Word to the Wise podcast series for HR and safety professionals. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Krista Lennard, partner at Kingston Reid.
And I'm Shelley Williams, senior associate at Kingston Reid.
And today we're going to discuss with you the independent contract dilemma. Now, there were two decisions of the full bench of the Federal Court of Australia handed down last week, each dealing with whether workers were independent contractors or employees. Now, this is a very well-versed topic, and ordinarily these decisions would be unremarkable. But for the fact that the decisions came down within one day of each other, both with different outcomes and some really interesting commentary from the judges as to how they reached those outcomes. Essentially, the cases were applying well-established principles of law when it comes to determining whether an individual is a contractor or an employee. However, as we'll discuss today, the law is never simple when it comes to considering multiple factors. And as we've heard in some of our previous podcasts, the layers of complexity can lend themselves to anomalous outcomes. Shelley, set the scene for us, because there's a great deal of case law and historical context, isn't there, when it comes to sham contracts and the test of whether a worker is indeed a contractor.
That's right, Krista. The manner in which the courts decide whether someone is an employee or an independent contractor, as you say, has been established for decades. The multifactorial approach was first determined in the Stevens and Brodrup's sawmilling decision in 1986. We then had Hollis and Verbu, which set out that multi-factor test. And the full court, as you'll recall, determined that bicycle couriers were employees, not contractors. From then, we had Ace Insurance in 2011 at first instance, and in 2013 before the full court, which determined that insurance agents who had their own business, their own cars, they issued invoices for GST for the services they rendered, were nevertheless employees. Previously, the courts had focused on the control test, which purely looked at the degree of control over an employer that an employer had over the individual. But over time, the courts have departed from this approach in favour of considering the totality of the relationship and doing that in a great level of detail.
And this departure has been in recognition that to truly understand the nature of the relationship, a multifactorial approach, looking at a number of indicia, needs to be taken into account when looking at that totality of the relationship, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's interesting because we therefore have a multifactorial approach, but in answer to a binary question, which is the individual an employee or are they a contractor? And it was Justice Lee in the CFM MEU and personnel contracting case that sets out the control test and the tensions that arise in the application of this multifactorial approach. Krista, I know that this is the case that has you most concerned. So let's start there. Do you want to tackle that one?
Yep, we're here to tackle the hard issues. And I think it's important to start with the context, and it's always good to have a bit of a factual background. So this case, which as I said earlier, was handed down last week, involved an individual by the name of Mr. McCourt. He was a 22-year-old backpacker, and he was engaged as a general labourer by Personnel Contracting Pty Limited, essentially a labour hire outfit, to provide services on two construction sites during 2016 and 17 under the supervision of Personnel's client, Hansen Pty Limited. So if you think about it, Hansen paid Personnel and Personnel paid Mr. McCourt. Now, the CFMMEU commenced proceedings against Personnel and in the first instance also against Hansen, and Hansen was later dropped on appeal, for compensation and penalties based on the argument that Mr. McCourt was in fact an employee, but he hadn't been treated as such, and accordingly he hadn't been paid in accordance with the relevant award. Now, some of the useful things to keep in mind here, Shelley, was that Mr. McCourt, had he been an employee and been paid in accordance with the award, would have earned 25% more. That is, he was earning 75% of what he would have been paid as a contractor than had he been an employee. Some other interesting sort of factual context As I said earlier, he was a backpacker. He wasn't required to provide any equipment or tools of trade when he came on site for Hansen. In fact, as one of the judges says in the decision, he walked down the road of the town that he was in after getting the job, and he purchased himself some high-vis jacket and some steel cap boots, and off he went. And the labourer tasks that he was performing for Hansen when he was on site was described in one of the judge's decisions as essentially sweeping floors and cleaning up and changing the bins. So here we have a very unskilled or low-skilled labourer job, but nonetheless he was engaged as a contractor under a services agreement through that personnel contracting Pty Limited outfit.
Now, the full court attempted to grapple with this tension.
They did.
Yeah. So talk to us about the tension and how they applied that.
Well, at first instance, I should say, just to go back again one step, that the judge, the primary judge, found that Mr. Bacourt was indeed an independent contractor. So the full court was looking at that decision and whether or not that was, appellable or factually correct. And they looked at a number of factors, and interestingly, this case isn't material to an earlier case, again, against the same company in 2004, and that becomes relevant. That's key to this decision, as we will later find out. But ultimately, the factors or the issues that, for a determination on appeal really came down to the court grappling with this concept of this multifactorial test and reinforcing that the assessment of the totality of the relationship involved looking at a number of indicia. And Justice Lee acknowledged it was an amorphous exercise, that it was susceptible to manipulation, and that the application of that test was open to inconsistency. So ultimately, he concentrated on three key factors. The first was the application of the control indicia that you spoke about earlier in the context of a tripartite or multilateral relationship, that three-pronged relationship. He looked at the extent to which the question of whether a potential employee is conducting their business or as being determinative of the characterization of whether or not they were a contractor or an employee. It was Justice Lee in the CFMEU and personal contracting case that ultimately then said, well, weight to be given to the contract at the end of the day is key also to one of those three tests. In relation to control, Justice Lee makes the point that the context of that tripartite relationship, that control indicia, has less work to do, which I think is really interesting, Shelley, because it's sort of imposing that contractual relationship in and saying that's the reason why that indicia of control is less important.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's because I guess courts often find that it is the client of the labour hire firm that exercises significant control over that person, that putative employee, not the labour hiring agency. And indeed, that was the evidence in this case. The CFMEU really led strong on that argument, and they acknowledged that it was Hansen who directed him on a daily basis when he did work. However, that doesn't necessarily suggest the relationship between the agency and the worker is one of principal and one of independent contractor. And the evolution of that new or novel labour arrangements, which may not be manifesting an employment relationship, is something that the court took into account. Ultimately, the court says that the level of control yields a natural result in the context of that trilateral relationship.
So moving on to the second category that the court focused on, and this was really the economic reality of the relationship. So the court here, what the court is considering is whether a commercial enterprise is operating as an ongoing concern with capital risk and whether that capital risk exists. Mm. That is what is referred to often as the entrepreneur test, and this is going to be considered obviously on a case-by-case basis. His Honour concluded that while it was not strictly necessary to express a concluded view, insufficient weight had perhaps been given to whether the employee was conducting a business on his own account. And in stepping back and having regard to the full picture, His Honour indicated that it was surprising to have a result that essentially ascribes the label of an independent contractor to a 22-year-old backpacker who's turning up to a work site to sweep the floors and take out the bins in his high-vis shirt that he's purchased down the street. But nevertheless, this was the view that was formed that he was ultimately a contractor. Now, moving on to the third category that the court considered.
And the court considered that the contract-centred approach that has been taken in some of the cases. Now, compare that to Hollis and Vibu and some other cases where they've emphasised the analysis of the whole relationship. This is one of the really interesting factors. And ultimately, Chief Justice also raised the question of the residual weight to be given to the contract, especially when other factors affecting that characterisation process were seen to be evenly weighed. And this comes back to the primary judge judgment, which was that ultimately the primary judge weighed the factors of the various indicia and said, look, some are employee indicia, some are contractor indicia, but overall, generally of the same weight. That in circumstances where we're satisfied there's no sham arrangement, and interestingly, the full bench really don't go into consideration about whether it was a sham arrangement. They accept almost, I guess, that the primary judge's view that it wasn't. That where there's that weighing that's quite equal, then ultimately, you go to what are the words of the contract. And in this case, the contract clearly stipulated that Mr. McCourt was to be engaged as a contractor, that he wasn't an employee. And on that basis, Justice Lee, I guess it was, noted that while in some circumstances it would be perfectly legitimate to give weight to the negotiated terms of the contractor, in this case, they were satisfied that based on that contract, that it wasn't a sham, and that that was the determinative factor ultimately that satisfied them that he was a contractor. Now, it's important to note in this case, because I think it is somewhat controversial and it is distinguished because of that tripartite relationship, but at the end of the day, the court does make it plain that they considered themselves restrained or constrained, bound, although not technically, legally they were, by that original CFMEMU and personnel contracting case in 2004. And I think, Shelley, that's the key distinguishing factor. It's interesting because both the dissenting judge of Allsop and Justice Lee and in the affirmative acknowledge that it's a peculiar outcome, don't they?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
That they really grapple with the fact that when all said and done, this guy wasn't conducting his own business, had no capacity to. It was this unskilled labourer, and yet at the end of the day, they find themselves making a decision that he's nonetheless, by virtue of that tripartite relationship and the key terms of the contractor, of the contract, therefore a contractor.
Yes. There is indeed a very uncomfortable tension between the application of this legal test, and this case really sets that out. And I think also when we compare the next decision, it will really strike out that tension. And there is obviously the complexity that's added, given that there's an ever-changing world of work that we live in, that in and of itself is making the application of this legal test quite difficult. I do think that changing nature of work and the rise of the use of the ODCO model and the gig economy is certainly putting pressure on the limitations of this test.
Yeah, I agree. And it's interesting because you look at some of the decisions that have come before this one, particularly in relation to gig economy, to the Uber and gig economy workers, and they've found, well, in certain cases, there have been instances where there isn't capacity to have another business and therefore they aren't contractors, they're employees. In this case, there was no capacity. It was established that Mr. McCourt didn't have capacity to have another business. Yeah. Yet in this case, he was deemed a contractor.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, interesting space. So let's move to one of the other decisions that was also handed down last week, and that's the decision of JAMSEC and ZG Operations. Shelley, do you want to explain what happened in that case?
Sure. So this case involved two truck drivers who were engaged by the company. Mr. JAMSEC commenced employment, and this is important because he commenced as an employee with the company in September 1977, and in 1988 he became a delivery driver. Mr. Whiteby began working for the company as well as an employee in their paint shop in October 1977 and became a delivery driver in 1980. Now, these facts are of critical importance because it perhaps leads into one of the key takeaways from this case. But in 1986, off the back of requesting a pay rise, the company stated that they were not prepared to do so and that the workers had a choice. Mm. So they were ultimately given an ultimatum, and that ultimatum was that they would either be made redundant or they would accept a change in the nature of the relationship, whereby they purchased the trucks from the company and they agreed to become contractors. The company offered to pay them carton rates with a minimum of $120 per day. Now, faced with that ultimatum, both workers chose the latter course and became contractors. They purchased the trucks from the company and they took on that capital risk and the expense. But as the court describes it, in terms of the actual work, nothing much changed. So the dispute arose in the context of vicarious liability, which is the case with all of these employee independent contractor decisions, where the workers are essentially arguing that they are owed employment entitlements. And as was the case here, both of the workers argued that they were entitled to accrued leave, including long service leave and superannuation.
So what are some of the critical factors, Shelley, having read the decision, that the court considered in relation to the contractual arrangements in this case? Because as part of this change in status, both of the workers set up partnerships and did what we would consider to be consistent with a commercial arrangements. And indeed, they benefited from the structure of the partnership from a tax perspective, and their partners became unit holders in that partnership as well.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Krista. Mr. Jamsek, on the advice of his accountant, set up a partnership with his wife in the late 1980s. His income was received and declared as partnership income until his working arrangement ended with the company in 2017. Mr. Whitby also set up a partnership in 1986. And between 1986 and the 30th of June 2012, his income was declared as business income of the partnership, and from that date his income was declared as business income personally derived from a transport operation or courier service business. The court accepted that this factually occurred. However, what the court took issue with was the fact that the drivers had essentially received that ultimatum, and this change in their status was at the volition of the company. It was not their own choice. And as you say, Krista, partnerships are obviously a legitimate commercial arrangement, but serious care and caution really needs to be taken into account when approaching current employees and requesting, or as it was in this case, requiring them to become contractors. The court is not going to look favourably on that, particularly where it can easily be argued that such an ultimatum is an attempt to obfuscate from obviously having to pay those employment entitlements.
Which comes back to that sham construct that exists in the Act. And I guess, again, of interest, the court went through those various contracts that existed, and it was clear that for periods of time, the workers weren't covered by any contractual arrangements. I mean, this was a long period, some decades, but nonetheless, they continued to work. And I should say, when you read this case as well, it's, the way in which they work is not dissimilar to the owner-drivers of arrangements that many truck drivers in this country work with. But essentially, the court said that if anything that lends itself to there being an employment relationship, because, if you were generally running a business, you would place more emphasis and importance on having contractual arrangements in place, that they looked at that, and they said that these two workers were content to continue working even during periods where they didn't have a contract in place. And so here's that elusive contract again. And in this case, the court says, well, there isn't a contract, so that's indicative of them being an employee. And the primary judge had concluded previously that the applicants could have sold the business, and that could have included goodwill or the capacity to generate goodwill. But the full court determined at the end of the day that the amount of goodwill had been incorrectly overweighted in that factorial test, given the drivers would only be selling at the end of the day the trucks and not other, another commercial arrangement. And I think indeed the contracts that applied over the years when this was examined expressly stated that there was no guarantee that work would continue if those workers had or contractors had their trucks indeed sold. So it's interesting because when you compare this with the first case, clearly Mr. McCourt didn't have any capacity for goodwill or any capacity to carry on a business or have any risk in relation to assets. But in this case, they did, and yet we get a different position.
That's exactly right.
So what other factors did the court take into account, Shelley?
Yes. So, Krista, as you mentioned, these were relationships that extended for over 40 years. So there were really significantly long relationships that were in place. And one of the factors that the court focused on was that over that time, both of the workers only ever worked for the company. The primary judge had concluded that even though this was the case, the workers had some flexibility around the hours that they worked, so they could leave and go home after they'd finished their trips. And while they didn't work for anyone else, there was the opportunity to do so, and nothing was stopping them from doing that. But the full court took a different view, and they said that, well, they attended for work for deliveries from 7 a.m. every day, and they generally work up until 3 p.m. every day. So they were working essentially a 9-hour day, 5 days a week. And while there was nothing stopping them from taking on other work, the court didn't accept that there was any option for them to work further hours. The court didn't accept that it was necessary for them to then be working in excess of 9 hours a day. And the court essentially said that it would be implausible for that to happen. The court also took into account the fact that, and these are the sort of more traditional factors that the court will take into account. So the fact that, you know, they were wearing branded clothing and the company logo was embossed on the trucks that they owned.
The old Hollis and Barbie trick.
So taking all of those factors into account, the court found that both drivers were in fact employees for the purposes of the Act, as well as for the superannuation guarantee, and that they were workers for the purposes of the Long Service Leave Act, so they were entitled to those benefits.
So I guess when we look at where this leaves us and some of the critical points to take away from these cases, from my mind, what appears to be the clear trend, at least, is that it's always going to be the substance over the form. And I think that's really reiterated in this JAMSEC decision when they do look at that substance of that 40-year relationship and the circumstances in which they became contractors. This is a consideration generally of the totality of the relationship. We've said this at the outset. The court says this. The difficulty comes when that's applied, as the personnel case really emphasises, that you can't always guarantee the outcome that's going to be, notwithstanding the layering of that multifactorial test to those circumstances. And it always also highlights the importance of constantly, I guess, from a practical review perspective, reviewing your contractor arrangements as good business hygiene, going back and applying those key principles on a regular basis. It's a terrifying outcome that after 40 years, two contractors are found to be employees.
It is.
And it highlights the importance of not simply accepting the arrangement, but, being critical of it and testing its veracity. I guess, Shelley, in doing so, what should organisations be doing?
You really need to go back to that checklist of requirements that the court is going to consider. And you have to really, it's a bit of a smell test, and that's what the court actually refers to it at times. But you need to think about whether the outcome is going to be intuitively unsound. So it's that smell test. Does it feel right? But there are obviously key critical criteria that you take into account when weighing up that assessment. The things that you really need to consider is, you know, does the worker have an ABN? Have they met other regulatory requirements, including insurances? Do they provide the services through a company? And is the company capable of creating goodwill or saleable assets in the course of the work that they're doing? Do you have control to direct the manner in which the work is being performed? And does the putative employer exercise or have the right to exercise control over the work? So do they get to determine the location of the work? Do they get to determine the hours of the work and the manner in which the work is being performed? Can you delegate? So can the individual delegate or subcontract to someone else? And can they work for different customers? The JAMSEC decision is obviously in line with that. So they only ever worked for the one customer. And finally, what is the intention of the parties and what do those contractual arrangements say? And I say that as finally because particularly with JAMSEC, you sort of see the trend in the court that it's not really, it's not going to be the form of the contract necessarily that is determinative of this. You really do need to look at the whole relationship and the nature of the relationship between the parties. And obviously the intention of that relationship.
Well, I think it's safe to say that for the time being, ODCO arrangements have scraped through.
Yeah.
I think it's a matter of time and they will be tested. And you know, the dissenting decision and even the commentary from the judges affirming the outcome and determining that appeal really demonstrate that. And what they demonstrate is that this is, as Shelley, as you've said, an amorphous exercise. It is susceptible to manipulation and that intuitively unsound principle, that application of inconsistency is the stress test. Really stress it, and if it comes out intuitively not feeling or smelling right, then there's likely to be some liability there. Thank you very much for listening. We hope that you found that interesting and we'll see you shortly in another podcast.